Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, January 8th, the Bright Young Things edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate, talking to you from D.C., and I'm joined in New York by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hello, Hannah. Well done.
Thank you. And hi, Noreen. Noreen of New York Magazine, that is. Hi,
hey,
Noreen.
Hannah.
Hi, Noreen. Hi. Noreen, I have to thank you because over the break, I got Elena Ferrante's trilogy about friendship
as
a present. Oh, my God. It is unbelievable how good it is. I mean, how just, you know, ordinary life is like full of drama and despair. For those of you listening, it's My Brilliant Friend is the first book, and she's an Italian writer who's been translated into English. Noreen recommended her a couple of shows back, and she's amazing. And the other thing is completely mysterious. You read about her, and it's like it's not her real name. She's never been interviewed in the press. She doesn't show up to pick up awards. I love this woman. I love her.
So great. And the thing that makes me mad is the speculation that she might be a man. Now that you've read it, like, there's no way it's a man,
no
right?
way. Absolutely no way. I mean, the way she writes about domestic life and the kind of violence behind it, not violence like in a political sense, just the day-to-day kind of resentments and violence and shifts of emotions. Sorry, dudes, no way. No way. Okay. June, before we go into our first topic, you have something to tell us.
Yes. So on Tuesday, February 3rd at City Winery on Varick Street in New York City, Outward, which is, as Hannah always likes to say at the top of the show, Slate's LGBTQ blog, is having a special live show. I'll be there, as will Brian Lauder and Mark Joseph Stern. And we're going to have a very special guest who I can't quite announce just yet, but oh my God, it's going to be so fantastic. So if you would like to get tickets, they are available at the price of between $15 and $22. Go to slate.com/outwardnyc for more information.
So on to our three topics. One, Providence Talks is a new program that tries to teach poor parents to speak more words to their toddlers to help them succeed. Or does it just impose middle-class values on them? Second, another marker of class, good teeth. Why can't poor kids get basic dental care and a program in Alabama that fixes that problem? Three, the phrase bright young things. Is it really a compliment or is it a secret insult? We discuss the many ways people can insult you while seeming not to. So our first topic, Providence Talks. Social scientists have long studied how talking to toddlers is good for them. It makes them better prepared for school, better able to negotiate for themselves later in life. What they've also discovered is a big word gap, it's called, between social classes. Poor parents tend to speak fewer words to their children. Now a few programs around the country have dedicated themselves to teaching poor parents to talk more. And in this week's New Yorker, author Margaret Talbot has a deep look into just how difficult that is. We have Margaret with us today. She's in D.C. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Hannah.
So just to get started here, the weird thing is that they actually tape the parents, right? Like they actually strap tapes on them and count the number of words. This isn't like an informal measure or a guess about how much talking we all do.
Right. I mean, what they're doing now in Providence Talks is having the kids, babies and toddlers, wear this device, which is a recording device that fits into a little vest that they wear, and it picks up all the words that are spoken within earshot, and also then can count them up and look at also taking out conversational turns. So like when a parent says something to the kid and the kid replies and the parent says something back, and it can also distinguish between actual human voices within earshot and technology, TV or computer sounds.
Didn't someone have like a Fitbit quip about it? Like Fitbit?
Yeah, it is kind of like that. And I think in a way, that's why a lot of the parents actually are responding fairly well to it, because I think we're used to this kind of technological self-improvement. And so the way this works with Providence Talks is that they do one session where they record for a day, and then this home visitor comes back and shows the parents this kind of, you know, printout graph of how much they talked that day and, you know, when they talked the most at what moments in the day. And then they can sort of say to the parent, what were you doing at that time? You know, could you do that more? Whatever it was. And the parents actually seemed to kind of respond well to that because it seemed less judgy to them, I think, because it seemed like objective data.
Hey, Margaret, I don't know if there's any way to really know the answer to this question, but I was really curious how it seemed to you if the Lena device, as I believe they're called, mm-hmm. is really, like, how accurate it is. It feels like there's a lot of sort of emphasis and being put on the data that comes from it, and I just don't have a sense of just how reliable it is.
Yeah, there's some questions about that. Some of the researchers I spoke to raised some issues about that. I mean, they have their own, you know, algorithm that they've developed. I think the temptation to use this to do all kinds of research, also with, you know, autistic children, hard of hearing children, and for other reasons, is so great because it sort of makes the research so much easier. The original Hart and Risley research that showed this big word gap, they actually, you know, recorded, it had like 1300 hours of recording, and then, you know, people had to sit and listen to the recording and literally count the words.
Right.
So this is something that's, you know, it's so tempting because it makes the process so much faster and easier, but it's true that there may be some information and some subtlety lost in that process.
So, Margaret, you watch some of these exchanges, mm-hmm. right? You watch this is basically a worker who's associated with a study who comes in. And it's not just a study anymore. This originated in a study.
Yeah,
this
is
idea.
An intervention to really try and get low-income parents to talk more to their kids.
Yeah, and I loved, by the way, your mention of Orange is the New Black, where Diaz says to Bennett, oh, there's all these studies that say if you don't talk to the baby, they end up, like, fucked up by the time they're five, right? So, like, the idea being, like, this is out there. Like, people get, it's not so foreign,
right.
This idea that you should talk to your babies. You described some exchanges that were a little bit awkward. Like, it seems inevitable that you have some researcher come in and try and tell a family that they should talk. Like, it's the first thing I think of are the cultural differences, just the class differences. You know, are we imposing our, like, oh, goo-goo-la-la, like talk to our babies on people who don't naturally do that. So what were the exchanges like? Did they seem natural? Was there a bit of both, some natural, some awkward?
Yeah, I think a bit of both. I mean, I think it's true. Like doing this piece made me think about, you know, why it is that, you know, as a general rule, people, and there are certainly exceptions, by the way, but, you know, as a general rule, you know, people parents of sort of the professional classes tend to do a lot more of this kind of back and forth and tolerate a lot more sort of, you know, debate from their toddlers and older kids and just do a lot more sort of, you know, didactic talking, like in the grocery store and things. I think we've all sort of noticed that. And I think the reasons are sort of cultural, and they also have to do with people's temperament and personality, which can, you know, obviously supersede class. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the awkwardness, you know, I think that these home workers try to be very sensitive, and they were, you know, I thought they were very good and very skilled at their jobs. But, you know, inevitably there are these moments like I described in the article where, you know, we're with this young mother who's kind of a working class, low income mother, and showing these videos that are, you know, depicting a woman who looks, I don't know, like she's shopping in a Whole Foods, and she's sort of wearing white jeans and, you know, is very blonde and coiffed, and she's just, you know, talking nonstop with her little guy about the, you know, organic almond butter they're buying. And it just seemed like a cultural disconnect. And I also just found it a little irritating, the amount of talk in this particular demonstration, you know, where it's somebody like nonstop, you know, narrating what they're doing. So, you know, I'm not sure that there are these moments that are awkward because there are these cultural disconnects, I think.
One of the most interesting pieces of your article to me was the idea that it's not just hearing words, like it's not just, you know, a conversation in the background, even if the kid is sitting there, it's having the words addressed to the child itself and having it actually be a conversation that they are participating in, even if they're just sort of like gurgling and smiling at it. And so that, you know, just made me think about like how we figure or how children figure out their sense of self, and then just wonder, like, all the way, like, how does it fuck you up by the age of five if your parents don't talk to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I was struck by is that there's really pretty good data that for kids under two, that electronic sound, electronic words really don't make very much of a difference. They're really like background noise for them, that it really has to do with this sort of emotionally inflected interaction. And, you know, they call that kind of talk motherese. It can be parentese, but it's that, you know, like, so big, look who's so big. I'm sorry, I have a cold, so I can't really do it today.
It was pretty good. I felt soothed.
I know, yeah.
No, that was,
I'm so big.
And, you know, I think that that is an emotional interaction as well as a sort of verbal one, and that seems to make a difference. I know that sounds sentimental, but it actually does seem to make a difference in terms of kids' ability to converse and even their vocabulary development.
I remember when I was doing research about iPads and toddlers, there was a lot of research into trying to create very mommy-like characters that toddlers could connect with. It was very Uncanny Valley creepy, kind of, but they sort of solidly believe that, in fact, there has to be an emotional connection. So how do you get little kids emotionally connected? How do you skip this gap between technology and humanity, you know, which is creepy.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when kids are over 2 years, it actually seems to work okay. I mean, you can learn things from electronic communication, but there's this woman, you maybe talked to her, Patricia Cool at the University of Washington, who did this research that was really interesting, where she exposed babies who were native English speakers to a Mandarin speaker in person.
And yeah, I love that.
Mandarin speaker on a TV, and basically they picked up Mandarin from the real person, but not from the television.
Uh-huh. Oh my God,
that's amazing. Yeah. Margaret, there's a kind of a line toward the end of your piece that I think was kind of said in jest. One of the people you spoke with said, you know, these families that we're dropping in on, that we're doing this intervention with, you know, they've just got a lot on. They have a lot to worry about, a lot to deal with, and maybe it would be more effective to bring them dinner and help them with the laundry, which, you know, clearly is not something that's really going to happen in the world. But I did kind of wonder if, you know, maybe just kind of helping working class and low income parents be more sort of confident, so that they feel that they have something that is useful to say. I mean, I feel that as somebody who grew up working class, that middle class parents tend to feel like they just have more confidence, and they tend to think that if people overhear them talking to their babies in that way, that it's going to be good. Whereas I suspect that more working class parents feel embarrassed by it because they are so used to being judged and found wanting that this is just another area where that could happen. And I just wonder if there's a sense in this program of just helping parents feel more confident about their ability to raise kids and just about themselves in a way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big question. I mean, I think, yeah, a lot of the confidence that middle-class parents seem to have, I don't know exactly where it comes from. It's complicated, right? But partly it's from education. And, yeah, when I watched this young woman who seemed like a really lovely person, you know, but she was sort of quiet and modest, and watching this woman kind of holding forth on the video, you know, in the aisles of the Whole Foods or wherever it was, you know, it just was a little hard for her to imagine doing that or doing it. And, yeah, I mean, I think education is extremely helpful in this way. I think this program realizes its limits. It realizes it's not, you know, it can't be wholly transformative. But I think it does, you know, I think they're partly with this data trying to give parents some confidence that they can see that, for example, they're talking more this week and it's something they're doing, you know. And, you know, I think also just trying to show people research that shows that it makes a difference to talk to your baby. Because some people, I think, also, yeah, either they're embarrassed or they sort of have the feeling that what difference could it make to talk to an infant who can't talk back, you know, to you. Mm-hmm. And also people are living under a lot of pressure day to day when, you know, you're, you know, poor or working multiple jobs, as a number of these parents were. You know, it's a little hard to have the sort of energy and wherewithal to, you know, be brightly playful and creative with your toddler. You're kind of just taking care of the basics because you have to.
Right.
So I think that comment made in jest about maybe we have the model wrong and maybe it'd be good to, you know, free parents up a little bit. Yeah, I mean, that would be great, actually. And this program can't really do that.
I love that part, Margaret, where you talked about where you reflected on why you talked to your
yes.
toddler when you had toddlers, because it made me think a lot about that, too. You know, was it that we were influenced by some brain research on how toddlers develop? Probably not. We were just bored, right? It's slightly boring. And unlike poor people, we had the space. Like, we had I had a paid maternity leave. I had time. I was sitting around my house. Most of the things were taken care of, right? My life wasn't that pressed at that moment. And so it's just boring unless you do something,
right.
You know, unless
I mean,
you get out
of
a book.
A lot of the reason that people go to, you know, library story times or Gymboree or whatever, because, you know, otherwise you're sitting around alone with a toddler who, yeah, is, as you say, it gets a little boring. And so I think if you have the idea that these resources are out there and you're used to using resources in that way, cultural resources, you do just to make it more lively and interesting, because it's the kind of thing you do in other aspects of your life as well. So yeah, I mean, I think afterwards you read the articles and you feel good about it, right? You think, oh yeah, I've been, you know, stimulating my baby's brain development, but that's not exactly why you're doing it in the first place.
And then you also mentioned that a lot of wealthier parents are just glued to their phone, probably because they are bored, but the effect is sort of the same, that you're not talking to your child. I wonder if...
Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, this researcher, Anne Fernald, who I talked to, who has done sort of more recent research, kind of updating the original word gap research, says that she's seeing more sort of intermingling of, at the extremes. So among poor and then among very wealthy parents, she does a lot of her research. She's at Stanford, and she does a lot of her research with Silicon Valley mm-hmm. parents. And she's finding actually that people who are addicted to their gadgets, like a lot of us are talking less to their kids.
I have to say, whenever I read about these kinds of programs, because there are a few around the country, they're obviously good, they're obviously noble, the research is solid, and yet my whole being kind of pulls against their larger effect in society, which is to completely valorize what we as middle-class and upper-class parents do, which is give children a sense of entitlement, very few boundaries, you know, let them be heard and argue all the time. It's obviously a great life skill, but sometimes when you see it in practice, I think, it's not very attractive. And there are also excellent things about the working class children. I was really, I mean, in terms of their politeness and the way they're bred and their independence.
And competence.
And general competence. And I was really happy to hear from Annette Leroux, whose research underpins all of this, mm-hmm. All of this work. Can I read what you wrote about her? Because I think it's important. She very solidly in her book, which is called Unequal Childhoods, right? Her 2003 book, that she didn't see the middle class approach as inherently superior. And she says the amount of talk in those households is exhausting. It involves a lot of labor, and sometimes parents are really not enjoying it. And sometimes kids use their verbal acuity to be really mean to each other. And then she found kids in poor and working class families to be more polite to their elders, less whiny, more competent, and more independent. Still, she concluded it was better because it sets you up better in life. So maybe as a last question, can you just walk that fine line there? Like, what does she mean by that? So it might, you know, because there's a tension there between character and success. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like a very modern idea about success, as different than the one you get in Unbroken, right? So there are these kind of competing models, sort of character versus entitlement, all these just complicated things in there in this research.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, really big question. And I just could touch on it in this article or raise it. I mean, it is true. I think that a lot of this, the middle class concerted cultivation, as Annette Leroux calls it, or middle and professional class, you know, approach to child rearing that we're familiar with, is, you know, it does produce kids who are really good at advocating for themselves and, you know, very verbal often, and often, yeah, kind of entitled and not particularly good at being forbearing or independent. And, I think that a lot of professional jobs that are available now are probably well-suited to the person who is assertive and talky and less so to the people, or a different kind of job is out there for, you know, someone who's been raised in the more, in the style that of the working class parents that Annette Leroux talks about. I don't know. I mean, I think these are, this is, I think the way that we are raising children and the class differences in the way that we are raising children is going to have a big impact on the kind of society we have. And I don't know, I don't know what to say about that, except that, you know, it is, and I'm not sure it's all to the good. But I think trying to give people a choice that if they sort of want to make it in the kind of professional society, you know, they may need to provide their kids with a different set of tools and a different kind of child rearing, to sort of talk to them about that and perhaps give them the choice is maybe a good thing. And that's part of what this program is trying to do.
Well, let's end on that hopeful note. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we move on to our next topic, which is good teeth, I want to read a letter from one of our listeners. This is, again, in praise of Noreen. Noreen, it's all you. It's all you this week.
Exciting. Exciting.
He says, I'm in complete agreement with the comment on boobs. When I was a boy, boobs were the same childish category as knockers and jugs. Mm-hmm. Knockers. I haven't heard that one in a while.
Great word. Very descriptive.
Actually, maybe we should go back to knockers.
Yeah.
The use of boobs by adults as a generic name for breasts is part of the infantilizing of our culture. Breasts are on women. Boobs are on calendars. Grow up, people. He's very pithy, this Miles Potter. Describes himself as a Slate Plus member, feminist, father, and penis owner.
Does he own it? I'm wondering about that.
I don't know. Does he own it? Does it own him? Or does he talking about like a statue of a penis? That he anyway, you're awesome, Miles. We really appreciate your writing in. Okay, dental care. Poor kids can't get dental care. Not because they don't have insurance, but because dentists won't see them, writes our own June Thomas. This is important because good dentistry, much like how much your parents talk to you, is a marker of class. Writes June, I remain convinced that I could never have had a career in an overwhelmingly upper-middle-class field of magazine journalism if it weren't for my wonderfully skilled and patient Seattle dentist, who spent a decade, listeners, do you hear that? A decade working on June's teeth. June visited Alabama, and today, up on Slate, is her wonderful story about a program that's solving this problem. June, it is a great, great story. I think we don't think enough about teeth as a marker of class. You know, it's kind of a joke in society, but we don't think about the actual implications of bad dentistry for the poor.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think dentistry is one of the most sort of touchiest fault lines in American society, because those of us who've had problems are very aware of it. And I think people who haven't had problems and who have, I want to give them credit, taken care of their teeth. I mean, it is not something that passively was given to them. They have, because they had resources perhaps when they were children, because they haven't had problems or gone astray, they've taken care of their teeth, they've had good teeth, and they just don't have any sense of, you know, the fact that people can't get to see a dentist, they can't afford to treat the problems that they have, that they live with pain or with, you know, infections in their bodies, or the fact that if you do have missing teeth or even messed up teeth, it's very hard to get a middle class job. And it's very hard to eat nutritious food. It's just, you know, it's a big problem. And if you haven't had it and you don't sort of mix with people who have these problems, there's no awareness of them.
So let's start at the beginning. What's the problem? Like, if poor kids have Medicaid, why can't they get dental care? Why can't they just take their Medicaid and go get dental care?
So nearly 47 million families have Medicare or CHIP. CHIP is a program for families that have an income that's too high to qualify for Medicaid but still is low. So those programs guarantee Medicaid benefits, dental benefits for kids, but the reimbursement rates, which are set by states, are low. They're lower than the rates that dental insurance companies pay. And dentists, most of whom in this country are private practitioners, that is to say small business people who must, you know, make their income by selling their services for more than it costs them to operate their offices, say they just can't work with Medicaid fees. You know, it is very expensive to set up a dental practice, to run a dental practice. Unlike doctors, unlike physicians, they tend to be, as I say, owner-operators. You know, they're paying for the equipment. They're paying the staff. They're paying rent. They're paying for the signage outside. And so they do have high expenses, and they can only work for a certain number of hours a week. And they certainly often choose to work less. You know, they've trained at great expense, and they don't necessarily want to work all the hours God sends. And so they say they just can't afford to treat Medicaid patients.
Is that true? You know, I had a sense reading your piece that dentistry, like the subject we just talked about, mm-hmm. has become just an inherently class-infused thing in a way that I didn't even recognize. Like, why would a dentist's office have such higher costs than a doctor's office? Or is it just that it is sunk into our minds that dentistry is a luxury? You know, I say this, I have great resentment against my dentist because David is like, he has moved us over to a very high class dentist practice. Mm-hmm. And they're just like fancy, and there's fancy paintings on the wall, and they talk like NASA scientists. They're like 232, and then they mark it down on a computer. I'm like, what the hell is this? Just get somebody to clean my teeth, you know, but somehow it's become kind of class divided. Like, dentistry is for the upper class, you know, and everyone else can go to hell. Like, why is it so expensive?
Well, it really is because they're small business operations. It's uh-huh. not like, you know, physicians tend to work in either hospitals or ambulatory care centers. They're not running their own office for the most part. But that doesn't mean that you're wrong. There is indeed, like, if you want to attract higher paying customers, which will be good for your bottom line, it's better to be exclusive. You want to have that fancy waiting room and those lovely state-of-the-art equipment, which is actually very expensive to operate and to own. And so there is a sense of being, it's good for a dentist to, in terms of their bottom line, to be exclusive, to have this air of, you know, this is a nice place to come. This is a good place to come. And so that's another reason why people don't treat Medicaid patients, because they tend to be poor and they look like poor people. And if you are a rich person going to your fancy dentist, which is costing you an arm and a leg, you don't necessarily want to rub up against poor people. Now, saying that out loud sounds really harsh, but it's kind of true. When Medicaid reimbursement rates go up, it doesn't tend to mean that more dentists see Medicaid patients. It tends to mean that the people who do see them see more of them. Or when dentists treat Medicaid patients, they tend to have them just come in on one day so that their waiting rooms don't mix.
That really broke my heart, that little detail right there, that, like, we can't mix the hoy, but, you know, that... That's just sad.
Yes.
You know, like, poor people on Tuesdays, everybody else every other day. Oh, they'll see them, like, in the most convenient hours possible or whatever.
June, this made me wonder, like, how dentists make their money, right? Just on a very granular level. So you say that, you know, these Medicaid patients come in and they get their cavities fixed and then they don't come in for, you know, the annual checkup. Is that where the money is in dentistry, the annual checkup, where it's very easy for them to just sort of, like, clean your teeth, the hygienist does it? Or is it in the, like, sort of, is it in the cavities? Is it in the cosmetic procedures?
Well, this is a tricky subject because, you know, there are different ways of looking at it. The basic belief is that if you have Medicaid patients, they're just not covering the cost of even running the office. So, you know, if you talk to dentists who are running their practice, they say, I just can't afford to treat these patients because, for every minute that they're in the chair, I'm losing money. So that's just a kind of a basic thing to get out there. And I don't dispute that, you know, people, it's very hard to judge exactly how much less the fees are, but it's supposed to be maybe 50% of the typical rate. So that is tricky. But the question of what do dentists want to do? Well, again, it's not clear. Some people would say just kind of having the basic things, you know, just having regular patients who come in all the time and, you know, on a regular schedule, who, you know, don't necessarily do a lot, but just will give, you know, keep your appointment book full. And that seems to be one thing that people say is a good thing. Obviously, these cosmetic procedures are also very good for the bottom line. I will just say that supremely patient and skilled dentist in Seattle who was so patient and dealt with me, it was a pain in the ass. I mean, yes, it cost me about $45,000. That's a lot of money.
Oh my God.
That's out of my own pocket. But every time I went to her, I was messing up her entire office. I was causing her to be delayed. All the patients who were on the schedule behind me were just always getting delayed because everything was complicated because my mouth is a mess. And so it is not necessarily a good thing to, you know, I'm not a whale. You know, a patient like me is not a whale that dentists are trying to reel in. It's like a pain in the ass. And so, you know, it is the ideal patient, I suspect, is that person who just comes in twice a year, who, you know, maybe brings their kids in. That, I suspect, is what dentists really want.
That's me. Yeah. I get a gold star from the dentist, which they always give you at the end, which irritates me, too. Like, I should be so happy because the dentist told me I floss well. $45,000, man.
No, it's up to about 59.
June's teeth look great, by the way. For anyone who doesn't have this visual, June is smiling right now, and her teeth look fantastic.
Excellent. I think we need to put your teeth up on
Facebook. I don't know if America's ready for that.
So let's move on to just the program that does work. Just give us a little brief on how it is that this guy, Jeffrey Parker, has solved this seemingly unsolvable problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, so this, the place that I went to visit that I write about in the piece is called Sorrell Dental. It's based in Alabama, in Anniston, Alabama, is where they started. It was actually started by a retired cardiologist, so not a dentist, but he, having worked in Calhoun County, where he grew up, just when he retired, he saw that the biggest medical shortcoming in his area, which is a poor area of a poor state, was the lack of provision of dental care. So he tried to set up a clinic, and it was really hard. So he called in this professor from the business school at the local university, Jacksonville State University, and that was Jeffrey Parker. This is a guy who had been a pretty high-flying executive at, like, food service companies, at ConAgra, at Sara Lee, places like that. And he'd retired at 40, and he was teaching in the business school as the kind of executive in residence. And his intention was just to go and give a consultation. But as he tells it, when he saw the kind of the shortage and the unmet need, he decided he would apply his business know-how to this potential practice. And I think it became like a challenge that he couldn't resist. You know, he's a very voluble, a very smart, a very kind of, you know, just a fun guy in a way, but he also it likes a challenge. So he decided he would bring business innovation to a dental practice. And so the, you know, the standard of dental care, the clinical care is just the same as everywhere else. But he brought in some kind of innovations from the world of business. So, for example, he has these outreach teams that go out and, you know, they go to schools and to Head Start programs and to rodeos and to, you know, fairs. They go everywhere to tell people with kids about this service. Now, you know, in a way, you say, well, OK, so he's off there getting customers. And yes, that's absolutely true. But just remember, these Medicaid kids, they have coverage, but they can't get care. So yes, he's trying to get customers, but he's giving them something that they really need that will save them so much pain and money down the line. And also, the standard of care is very high. There's, you know, one thing that was very hard actually for me to kind of express in the piece is that there are clinics, there are chains that provide care to Medicaid dentistry. They're run often, usually, in fact, by for-profit companies. And usually they have bad reputations. Now, I have not studied them intently enough to know if that reputation is earned. But the reason they have a bad reputation often is that people say that they provide excessive care, care that isn't needed, treatment that isn't needed, because that's the only way they can make money. And at Sorrell, the way that they organize the dentist kind of care is very much set up so there is absolutely no incentive for the dentist to provide treatment that isn't needed. And I think that they've taken a lot of steps to make sure that there's no indication of that whatsoever. And even though these business practices are unusual in terms of the dental profession, there is a, you know, a chief dental officer who really pays close attention. The fact is that dentists get to see each other's work, which is something that doesn't typically happen in a more typical dental practice. And so there are lots of kind of checks to make sure that unnecessary care isn't being done, which is the biggest problem that is associated with clinics.
June, do you think dentists have a sense of mission in the way a lot of doctors have a sense of mission?
I think on the whole, I'm not sure that they do. I mean, I'm not down on dentists. You know, I love dentists. I find their work fascinating. And I do.
I find it terrifying, personally.
This is why I love June. I have to say, listening to you talk to you, and it's like when I go to weddings of people where you think like, you know, it is so beautiful that the universe brought these two people together in their very particularity and passions. That's how I feel about you and Jeffrey Parker. It's like the way that you infuse your you think dentists are heroes, and
Jeffrey Parker thinks
dentists are heroes, and you found each other and like created this miracle of dentistry. It's kind of amazing. It's just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I really do believe that dentists are heroes. They're lifesavers. If more people could get to spend time with them and get the benefit of their help, I think it would transform this country. And I think it would do a great deal to address the class divisions in this country. It wouldn't solve them, but it would help.
Oh, my God. That was like the dentistry manifesto.
do they have a sense of mission? The ones at Sorel do. I do really believe that dentists do want to help people. That's why they go into this profession. However, again, the way that the business is set up, that they are small business people, they're owner-operators. And, you know, just the basic need, it's just a part of capitalism, that they must, you know, they really do need to make a profit. It just the way the system is set up makes it very difficult for them to treat people who I really believe they would like to. Who doesn't want to help kids who need to see a dentist? Nobody has that response in and of themselves. So, yeah.
So everyone should go onto Slate today, this week, and read June's marvelous piece, Disrupting Dentistry. Let's move on to our third topic, Bright Young Things. This is how Slate writer Katie Waldman, who is sometimes on our show, describes what it felt like to be a bright young thing or be called a bright young thing by her boss. She writes, I felt flattered at first, but the phrase also foregrounded the power differential between us, an older man and a younger woman. The effect was almost similar to that of being politely catcalled. I felt not like a serious writer, but like a luminous flibbertigibbet. It was great to see that spelled out, by the way, flibbertigibbet. An enchanting yet trivial object to be passed around the grown-up table. Katie's is a wonderful piece. It also brought up this question of, are there other such insult compliments? Are they particular to women? Is there a difference between the insult compliments applied to women and men? And what kinds have we experienced? So let me ask you the gender question first. I did try and think about this. It's not that women are particularly subject to these things, because Katie also mentions a few that could be just as well applied to men, things like wunderkind or firecracker or things like that. These other sort of dazzle of light type it girl, it boy, so-called compliments. So did you guys start to make distinctions between what kinds of insult compliments were applied to women and what kinds were applied to men?
Well, I think the age question is what we're really talking about here. Yeah. And for a man to be called a wunderkind, first of all, men are called wunderkinds until they're like 40, right? Which is when we're ready to put women out to pasture. But men are wunderkinds until they are fitted for their funeral suit. But for women, the question of age is so much more charged. Even professionally, somehow it feels like for women we have an expiration date. And so to be called a bright young thing is to be told, okay, this is your window where we're interested in you. And there's like a sense of foreboding in that compliment even.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I think I don't know which boss. It's not a Slate boss Katie was referring to. But
it's my husband, actually.
Yeah, that's what my guess was. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you know, so I'm older than your husband. And, you know, so as somebody who is older, I am very aware of just, young people are a threat. Young people come in, especially to our business. They come in and they eat our lunch. There are no people left at my age at Slate. You know what I mean? Like, it is, the youth threat is immense. And so I absolutely feel that, yes, there is a sexist sort of ageist component to this. But, oh, my God, it's so true. These young people are...
You're in favor of undermining bright young things.
No, I'm not. But I absolutely...
Keeping them in their place.
I absolutely understand where what I'm sure is a subconscious sort of... You know, almost like expressing a hope that it is evanescent, that there, you know, the whip does crack and then sort of shrivel up, or that the firecracker explodes and then, you know, floops, or that the bright young bulb burns out. No, I mean, I don't literally think that, but I think it is just a reflection that youth does fade. However, talent doesn't. And, you know, talent spotting is, you know, is something that needs to happen when people are young, or typically does. And so, yes, it is backhanded compliment, but it is still a compliment and it's reality.
So, June, you've just scrambled my mind. I actually have a response to that aging thing, but I'm going to leave that for a moment, a kind of hopeful one. But the distinction I was making was between superficial looks and intellectual prowess. You've just smashed that distinction. But what I was thinking is the problem with the insult compliments applied to women is that they talk about a visual in some way, whereas the ones about men often talk about intellectual prowess. I think they're equally anxiety producing. I mean, to be called a wunderkind makes you nervous, right? Because it makes you feel like you've got this one little moment, you know, like a physicist or a mathematician to prove your genius. And then that moment is over and you too are put out to pasture. But it's at least it's about your intellect and it isn't about something flashy or bright or glittery, you know, like the tragedy of the actresses, right? Every time we have a facelift disaster, often Amanda Hess will then write about, you know, the tragedy of, say, Hollywood's It Girl, right? Calling someone an It Girl, mm-hmm. and the way that actresses are treated as a kind of raw, renewable source, I think she once called it, which is to say they're just sort of put through the mill and every year there'll be a new It Girl. And mm-hmm. so, you know, you'll literally be put out to pasture after a year. I think her best expression of this was in her post about Renee Zellweger and that horrible moment when she came out looking nothing like herself. But do you think it's true that the women ones always contain a sort of superficial element, where the male ones are about kind of Silicon Valley wunderkind intellect?
I think that's totally true. The sort of undermining compliment that I have been thinking about, a boss once wrote me it was meant as a very nice note about something I'd written, and he said, oh, this piece totally had your voice. It was so brassy. And I just recoiled because, like, what the hell, man? Who wants to think of themselves as, like, a brassy dame, you know? And that's you think of Noreen, you think of brassy. And I think he just, like, hadn't thought about it as much as I was thinking about it. But there was something like, okay, this shines brightly. It's a reflective surface. But he wasn't saying, like, oh, this is, like, such a deeply considered work of journalism. He was like, brassy, hey, Kitty, what else Noreen, you got?
Noreen, you are not brassy. I just want to say that at all.
It also sort of scrambled my like, is this really, like, how people see me? That's strange. But it's the same thing when people... This isn't related to work, but, you know, people will often say that a woman's cute, you know, which has a mm-hmm. just a way of sort of minimizing while complimenting. Mm-hmm. There is something going on there.
That's like boobs.
I overthink words. It's true.
Yes.
No, I mean, I definitely it's undeniable that that this is gendered. Even when you were working through those words before, Hannah, like it girl, it's condescending, sure, but it's. You could see that somebody would say, no, I meant it as a compliment. Whereas you would never, ever hear the term it boy. That has never been used in the history of the world.
What about for gay men? Like, do gay men get subject to the same treatment as straight women? Like Liza Minnelli, Kim Novak, Renee Zellweger. Is there like a gay man in that list, you know, where they're described by their superficial appearance more than by anything else, condescendingly?
Well, I mean, I guess that depends kind of what situation we're talking about. I would be very interested to know if obvious gay men or openly gay men are sort of have those words applied to them in a way that straight men don't. I think it would reveal something about the minds, the subconsciouses perhaps of the people who offered those descriptions. But I actually don't know if that happens particularly.
Now, so my man moment was the end of last year when I published these three stories in a row, and it seemed like I was like exquisitely productive, you know. But they just
it did seem that way.
I got tweets at me that was like, Hannah Rosen has really reached her peak, or one was like, she's had a great hitting streak, and I was like, fuck! it really gave me anxiety for like a month because like the peak, it made me visualize how I was now falling off the peak. That's just, like, why would you say that to someone? Like, was that meant as a diminishing compliment, or was that genuinely meant as an offhand compliment and I should just take it as such? But it really caused me anxiety.
I should say hitting your stride. I think that's a better, because it's like, okay, I can jog, I can hold this pace for a long time.
That's good. I think, though, what we're pointing out is that it is really hard to give a compliment these days because we're all so fixated on, like, analyzing and we're all have this anxiety about our careers and about our, you know, ability to support ourselves. And so we do kind of overanalyze everything. I mean, even I was trying to think earlier of another, like, what could you say to a young person? Because you want to encourage them and you want to say, oh, my God, I think you really have talent. You really have potential. It's not realized yet, but I think you really could. Like, even saying something like up and comer, like,
you're a talent. You're a talent.
Yeah. You have talent, or that was wonderful. I think you're on, same as you would say to someone when they wrote a story that needed a lot of editing, right? You would say, this is, you know, this, you're great. You have a lot of, you wouldn't say raw talent. Yeah. I think what I would do is say the things that they're good at, uh-huh, like in a specific way, and then the things that they need to improve, but you need to do this. The same way I would do if I was talking to someone about something they'd written.
So basically what we're saying is we probably should avoid giving blanket descriptions to people that aren't about their specific abilities or talents?
No, temporal descriptions, okay, like, mm-hmm, things that have a time limit on them or where the alarm goes off. It's like, you know, you've got this limited window to prove yourself. Like, yeah, you know, hold up the Edith Perlman review who had, right, you know, who wrote Honeydew and who sort of was recognized in her 80s. Like, well, you know, just that's, there's all sorts of ways to be successful in this world. I want to say one more thing, June,
yes,
to just as addressed specifically to you, because you had that riff about, you know, the young coming to eat you. You know how Tina Fey has this whole thing about how in Hollywood you become invisible when you're 40? So my friend has reframed this for me. She says that actually invisibility, you should start to think of it as a superpower, you know? Like, really, like, because no one can see you, you can shed a lot of the different worries as you enter your 40s and 50s, and you can just kind of create, achieve, and not play in that way anymore. That there is a kind of freedom in that invisibility that we don't take enough advantage of. What do you think?
It just seemed like a way of, what do you call that, you know, turning broken eggs into scrambled eggs or whatever that phrase is, or an omelet. But I think that's something to focus on.
All right.
I have one more thing about the bright young things. It just occurred to me that if men were called bright young things or, you know, brassy or whatever, they wouldn't overthink it. They'd be like, yeah, I am a fucking bright young thing. Like, I'm a winner.
See me shine, baby.
Right. So I think it's all, you know, a wunderkind could be just as undermining if you think about it. So I think maybe we should stop allowing ourselves to be undermined.
Okay. Right, well, like Rihanna it up.
Yes.
I shine bright like a fucking diamond.
There you go. All right, we're doing it.
All right, let's move to our recommendations. Noreen.
I am going to recommend the new Nicki Minaj album, The Pink Print, which is an answer to Jay-Z's The Blueprint. And it's just a good album that people talk a lot about, like, why hasn't Nicki Minaj made her great rap album? Which I think is kind of a sexist thing to say, because there's a very specific definition of what a great rap album is. But anyway, the thing I love about this album is that she raps about how much she loves her mom.
Aww.
Which in the era of Drake and Kanye, male rappers do too. But to me, that always reads like, look at how sensitive I am. Like, you know, want to come over, baby? But this just seemed like a genuine, like, my mom's awesome rap. And it's just a good breakup album.
So I have to now confess, because it's so inappropriate at my age, that I have been listening to Only on repeat every time I'm alone in the car. And I'm like, you know, my son loves hip hop. And I just, like, there's not like two words of that song I could play to him.
Yeah.
It is just, you
know, it's a dirty song.
It is such a dirty song. And like, it's so badass in a way that's like trying too hard, but still, like, how else are you gonna play in that world, right? Like, I know we're supposed to think Nicki's like, you know, we're done with Nicki and it's too much Nicki already, but
no, oh, man, are we?
That song is scary, like scary. Like, if you live in that world, that's how you have to fight back. I just love that song.
Have you seen Nicki Minaj's pickle soliloquy, Hannah? Google.
Yes.
Okay. If
yes.
people haven't, Google Nicki Minaj.
I love Nicki Minaj. I love Nicki Minaj. So I have to hide it because Nicki Minaj is a little age appropriate, I think.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
She's, I don't know. I also think we're not supposed to be over Nicki Minaj. I think she's pretty cool.
Okay. Well, maybe we can ask our listeners, if they've made it this far in the show, to tell us if Nicki Minaj is age, if only bright young things are allowed to listen to Nicki Minaj. Okay, I'm going to do a much more age-appropriate recommendation. The other book I read besides the Elena Ferrante series when I was on vacation was Department of Speculation by Jenny Ofill, which is another book about an exact same subject in a completely different way. It's, again, one of these semi-autobiographies. It's also about marriage. It's about the quiet desperation, violence, weirdness of marriage, and also a kind of tender poem to marriage and its longevity. So I really think it's a great, fabulous, poetic, slim, and yet completely intense book. June.
I would also like to recommend a novel, The Perfect Mother by Nina Darnton, which I confess I did start reading because I was told that it was sort of a riff on the Amanda Knox case. So a mother gets a call in the middle of the night and her daughter, who's on a study abroad year, in this case in Spain rather than Italy, she gets a call and says that she's been arrested and she's in jail. And so she goes over to Spain to, help her daughter. And so it has that element to it, but it's actually more satisfying as a story of a perfect upper middle class mother and wife who realizes over the course of the novel that she has kind of, in her quest for perfection, has been blind to a lot of the sort of realities of motherhood and marriage and just life. And I found it a real sort of page turner of a novel. And I also enjoyed the portrait of Spain because I did live there for a couple of years and I always like to read about midnight dinners.
Sounds excellent. There's also The First Bad Man, by the way, by Miranda July, which isn't out yet, so I can't recommend it because I haven't read it, but I'm sure I will. A few shows down the road.
All right, then.
All right, then.
Sure, I will.
No, I love her so much, so maybe everyone read it. Maybe we'll even talk about it on a show. Anyway, so we'd like to thank our producer, Anne Hepperman, the managing producer of Slate Podcast, Joel Meyer, executive producer, Andy Bowers. If you'd like more information about our show, please visit our show page, slate.com/XX. Go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, or email us, XXGabFest@slate.com. And of course, subscribe to us on iTunes so other people can learn about our show and you can help spread the word. Thank you, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Find light in the beautiful sea. I chose to be happy. You and I, you and I. We're like diamonds in the sky. You're a shooting star I see. A vision of ecstasy. When you hold me, I'm alive. We're like diamonds in the sky. Of some